Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. During the Thanksgiving through Christmas and New Year's holiday season, all of the major U.S. TV news outlets will be showing traditional scenes of U.S. soldiers who get to come home to their families for short R&R visits. Their hugs and smiles will make it seem as if these soldiers and others like them are doing well. But there is another reality, and it's often unseen. After nearly a decade of war in the Middle East, some U.S. soldiers have been deployed as many as six times. And while the military appears to still be voluntary, there is no official draft. U.S. soldiers are often forced to go back, even though they don't feel up to another tour of duty or don't want to go. We marked the start of another holiday season in 2010 with grim statistics, as more soldiers are killing themselves than are dying in battle. These soldiers are part of a growing number of GIs who are not getting treatment for symptoms of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, or war trauma. The military seems to want to help them, but according to our guest Jeff Hanks, they may not even understand the scale of the problem or how it's affecting even those who feel a sense of patriotism and duty. Today we'll hear the second half of our interview with 1st Infantryman Jeff Hanks. When we interviewed him for our November 11th program, Jeff Hanks was AWOL and seeking treatment. He had already been deployed once to Iraq and once to Afghanistan, and he remained committed to the force, but he did not feel fit for another deployment after having had a panic attack at the airport. Instead of shipping out, he left the airport with his family and began a search for treatment. Private health care professionals saw him as very much in need of mental health care. He had seen some terrible things, including an instance involving a young girl who was about the same age as his young daughter.
I can still see her. I mean, like, it never goes away.
Not only does his memory of a young, suffering child who was about the same age as his daughter haunt Jeff Hanks, he also explained that, like many other U.S. soldiers, he had been in close proximity to at least one major blast.
I ran for it, and they were firing at the same time. And, you know, I was doing my, you know, 3 to 5 second rushes like we're taught, trying to, you know, take cover here and then run for it, you know. So I made it right beside our CP building, our command building, and the mortar hit the roof on the building right above me. I was right beside the building, and it blew me against the wall. I hit my lower back. It really dazed me. I don't remember getting back to my bay where my platoon was. That was like, it was usually like a 3 to 5 second, you know, walk. So I don't remember that much time. I got back, and the first thing I remember after that is putting my body armor on, getting ready to take up positions. And my medic was like, you know, are you okay? And I said, yeah, yeah. And I was so dazed. And I started getting sick to my stomach. And he said, okay, that's it. He said, we need to take him to the aid station. So they took me to the aid station. They gave me an MTBI test, a traumatic brain injury test, which I scored 21 out of 30. I failed it. So they set me down for 24 hours with a concussion. And after that, you know, I went back to the aid station. I had a severe headache afterwards and my ringing in my ears. I went back to the aid station, and for a couple days, you know, I still had headaches, but then they went away for a couple of days, and the aid station had me come back, you know, every day, and you know, I'm not going to lie, I was like, well, my headaches are gone for now, you know, and they said, okay, great, they said, you're fine. They never did a CAT scan on me, they never did an MRI, and I told them, I said, I did not hit my head, I hit my back, and I don't think they even really listened to me, but, you know, I understand they had a lot going on at the time, you know, I know there's probably people that are, you know, probably going a lot worse than I was. So, you know, that I understand that. But, and then after a couple of days of not having any bad headaches, you know, I was back on duty. I started having headaches again pretty frequently and a lot of tightness in my back. But they didn't do anything for me, really. They gave me, you know, Motrin. And, you know, that didn't really do anything for me. I mean, I took it, but they didn't really do anything for me. So then shortly thereafter, a couple weeks after, I came home on leave. So I've been dealing with headaches ever since, pretty frequently. When I get them, they're pretty bad. Like, I actually had one all last night, and I try to sleep it off, but I woke up this morning with it, but it finally went away.
We'll hear the second half of our interview with Jeff Hanks in a moment, and also from reporter Sarah Lazar, who covered his story in truthout.org. First, this update. Shortly after our interview with Jeff Hanks, he became much better known to the American people with a CBS News interview. He then turned himself into the military in the hope that he would receive mental health care for PTSD. The initial road to care was mixed, as he first told CBS News that the first appointment he had lasted only 10 minutes and seemed politically motivated. The counselor told Hanks that if, in fact, he had PTSD, he, quote, wouldn't be able to sit in that chair right now. CBS reporter Armin Katayan stayed with the story, learning on the following day, November 16th, that Jeff Hanks felt a bit better after another appointment with a military mental health care provider. Hanks said things were looking up. But as you'll hear, the road for him and other soldiers is not easy. Groups like Iraq Veterans Against the War, IVAW.org, are trying to help. There is also Courage to Resist and the GI Rights Hotline. Their number is 877-447-4487. Sarah Lazar is the reporter who first interviewed Jeff Hanks. She's also part of the Civilian Soldier Alliance and is working with IVAW and Courage to Resist. Together, they're trying to end the military's policy of redeploying soldiers despite combat stress and even TBI, traumatic brain injury.
Jeff Hanks refused deployment because he was not mentally well enough to deploy back to a war zone. He had already been deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan, and he was suffering symptoms of severe post-traumatic stress disorder. And when he sought help while on R&R leave, he was actually told by the command that he would have to deploy before his treatment had even really begun, before he could even finish testing. And his command actually interfered with his treatment and ordered his military doctors to give him clearance to deploy. And I think this is an important story to cover because this is happening more and more as the war in Afghanistan reaches into its 10th year. The military is increasingly desperate to get more boots on the ground and is resorting to deploying and redeploying traumatized soldiers beyond their physical and mental capacities.
During our interview with Jeff Hanks, he explained that an artillery round had gone off near him while he was dodging bullets, and he hurt his back. He's also suffered with headaches ever since and has been, at least on a preliminary basis, diagnosed with PTSD. Why don't you tell us more about his service?
He's served in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's an infantryman in the 101st Airborne Division, and he's experienced a lot of really horrible things while he's been deployed. You know, in Iraq, he saw a young girl the same age as his oldest daughter, blown to bits, essentially, but still alive. It had a really lasting impact on him. It was very, very troubling. He said he still has nightmares about it. And while in Afghanistan, he also saw really horrible things. He saw comrades from his unit die right in front of him. So in my conversations with Jeff, I've just really found that he's been through a whole lot. The military has sent him into war over and over. And now that he's experiencing the mental effects of being in combat situations, he's realizing that he just can't be deployed again. He's not okay. He's not well enough. And I think that this is a really important thing for people to know about, because at the same time that war traumatizes and destroys the lives of people living under occupation, it also traumatizes the occupiers and the people who are tasked with carrying out these orders on the ground. And we think it's especially cruel and inhumane to be deploying soldiers over and over in a war that doesn't seem to be leading towards anything other than more cycles of trauma.
In her story in truthout.org, Sarah Lazar writes, quote, "According to the Department of Defense, even if a military medical professional deems a service member unfit to deploy, a commanding officer can waive medical evaluation and order the service member into combat. While the DOD is not forthcoming about the rate at which this occurs, high rates of PTSD and multiple deployments suggests that cases like Jeff Hanks are common. Almost 30% of troops on their third deployment suffer severe mental health problems. By 2008, nearly 33% of troops had served two tours in Iraq or Afghanistan, while 10% had served three tours, trends that can only increase as the war in Afghanistan reaches its 10th year. Today, over 11,000 troops have served 6 tours, with each tour greatly increasing a service member's chances of developing mental health problems, including PTSD, TBI, traumatic brain injury, and combat stress, as well as military sexual trauma caused by rape and sexual assault from within the ranks. Top military brass acknowledge that suicide and violent crimes plague the military.
That's the rules according to what we read in the military's own text. I think it's a really horrendous practice. I think that it leads to all sorts of abuse of our service members. And it's also fundamentally unsafe for people in Iraq and Afghanistan because, you know, an occupying presence that is traumatized and that is not mentally well is going to be more dangerous for the civilian population. I think it's widely acknowledged now that suicides and post-traumatic stress disorder and combat stress, as well as military sexual trauma, rape from within the command, rape and sexual assault, are widespread problems. And we've all been reading in the news that suicides are skyrocketing and even top military brass is alarmed. Iraq Veterans Against the War has a campaign called the Operation Recovery Campaign, which is aimed at stopping the redeployment of traumatized troops. This campaign is built around the understanding that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan could not continue if it weren't for the traumatization and re-traumatization and redeployment of wounded soldiers. And so Iraq Veterans Against the War, as well as their civilian allies, are working to end this cruel and inhumane practice, both to stop a practice that's unfair and unjust, and also to withdraw consent from wars that are traumatizing everyone involved. The campaign Operation Recovery was launched October 7th of this year. It's led by Iraq Veterans Against the War in alliance with several organizations. So the campaign is aiming to stop the redeployment of traumatized troops. And folks in the Operation Recovery campaign will support anyone who refuses deployment because they can't survive another deployment or they're not well enough to deploy. And Iraq Veterans Against the War is an organization comprised of around 2,000 service members who have served since September 11, 2001. And IVAW calls for immediate withdrawal from Iraq and Afghanistan, reparations for the people of both countries, and full benefits for returning veterans, including mental health benefits. And the organization also stands in open support of GI resistance. And I'm a member of the Civilian Soldier Alliance, which is a group of civilian allies that work in collaboration with Iraq Veterans Against the War to support veterans while organizing against the war, as well as GIs organizing against the war and organizing for their rights. And another group that's really stepped up to help out and support Jeff Hanks is Courage to Resist. So Courage to Resist is an organization that supports troops who refuse to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Journalist Sarah Lazar, you're listening to Talk Nation Radio. You can learn more at our website, talknationradio.org. On November 6th, Admiral Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told NPR's Scott Simon that the military doesn't understand the problem of suicide very well.
There's not a lot of great literature on this, and we've put in place a very comprehensive study over the course of 5 years. We're about a year into it, to really try to pull this apart. We've also taken steps immediately to have leaders intervene, to train our people, to review every single case to try to understand this. And yet there's still a great deal that we don't understand.
First Infantryman Jeff Hanks had some thoughts for Admiral Mullen and the White House on what they can in fact do to help soldiers with PTSD and to prevent suicide.
I want them to, I understand that they see it as a problem. At least they're talking about it, which is always good to bring it up. I don't think they even know how widespread the problem is because, you know, like President Obama, I mean, when you're that high up of power, you're kind of shielded. You are, and you don't get down with the private first classes and the specialists, the young E5s that a lot of these people are dealing with. These people are dealing with the problems of all ranks, but especially I know it's young guys. I think, I'm not sure the statistics here, but I know it's usually like 20 to 24 of people with suicide rates. I would ask them to, instead of, you know, relying on your staff to tell you what's going on. Get the knowledge firsthand. I know it's, you know, outside the chain of command, but go to these places, go to mental health clinics, talk to soldiers firsthand who are dealing with this kind of stuff, and you're going to need to change the culture. I know it's really hard to do, but there's a, you know, macho, you know, if you seek help, you're a pansy culture, which has got to change, because that is why you have so many problems with people who don't think they can go out for help. You're going to need to get down with the lower ranks and, you know, talk to them personally, because that's the only way they're going to know, you know, what kind of widespread. I don't think they really realize. I mean, they can say they do, but I don't think they realize, you know, how many people are affected and how many people who don't go for help are either self-medicating or drinking it off. And, you know, there's a lot of people in denial. So they say the right things, but it's like it's not getting across. And I think they need to be a little more proactive and hands-on with it.
Coming up, we asked Jeff Hanks to talk about the response he's gotten in the United States now that he's home with PTSD. And we also asked him to talk about the events in Iraq and Afghanistan that left him with war trauma.
When I came home on leave, you know, it's, I think a lot of people, like people that I saw in the airport in Atlanta especially, you know, everybody thanks you for your service, which, you know, we appreciate and everything like that, but it's kind of like they romanticize it. They think that we're, you know, it's not romantic. I think that happens a lot, and I think they don't understand really how brutal it can be. And, you know, when people get hurt, it's for real. It's not Hollywood. You know, it's not makeup. And I think that we have, like in Afghanistan, I think that we have good intentions. I really, like in our area, you know, they're trying to start schools and stuff like that for little girls that the Taliban can never go. You know, that's a good thing. And the Taliban is evil. I mean, after seeing how they do, you know, they need to be engaged, but it needs to be right. And one thing I can say about Afghanistan is we do go to great lengths to try to avoid civilian casualties. But they're basically putting us in an impossible situation where, you know, we want to engage the Taliban, but the Taliban are around civilian areas. They dress like civilians. We can't tell who is who. We don't want these people to, we don't want the Afghan civilians to suffer. And, I mean, everybody's like that over there. We don't want them to suffer. But, you know, constant fights with the Taliban is happening. It's making it happen. So, you know, I feel that, you know, they would be better off, obviously, without the Taliban. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And we do have good intentions. But I think the way it's being fought is almost an impossible situation for your average grunt on the ground. Because, I mean, you got a 19-year-old kid with, you know, a 50-caliber machine gun behind him up in a turret. You know, with that kind of firepower, it's an impossible situation. I mean, everybody's really on alert and on guard, you know, and we're just out there kind of being ducks on a pond to get shot at. So, you know, they kind of put us in an impossible situation. But we do try, you know, to do the right thing. It's just sometimes hard.
And right now, Jeff Hanks, the U.S. military and others in the field with the U.S. military in Afghanistan are trying to contain Kandahar. I mean, that's sort of where we were maybe a year, maybe 2 years ago. This is a 9-year war. What about that problem?
The Taliban, though, I mean, will always come back. You're never going to fully get rid of them, and it's always going to be a guerrilla war. So I think, you know, I think we're just hitting our head against the wall on this. I think, you know, okay, yeah, we won that battle, but it's going to be a constant, you know, you're going to have sniper fire, you're going to have constant threat for these forces that take this city. So it's never going to be like we're liberating Paris where the Nazis are gone. I mean, they're always going to come back. And, you know, I just think it's a never-ending cycle. If you hit them one area, they'll move another one. And they just constantly move. And they're not dumb enough to engage us one-on-one. I mean, they're not. And they're not going to come out for the, you know, the great Civil War battlefield where they, you know, meet us out in the field and we fight it out. That's never going to happen. So, you know, we can take these cities, you know, in which we eventually will, you know, because I know it's the birthplace of the Taliban. It's you know, their heart, so we want to take it from them. But what I worry about, okay, we get there, and, you know, the Taliban, you know, some will fight, some will stay and fight and battle it out in the streets of Kandahar. That's a given. But there's going to be a lot of them that melt away and come back for a later day. And it's really hard. I mean, how are you supposed to deal with that? Because it's the right idea, but you need the Afghans. I really think that you need an Afghan face on it because, you know, Americans are there. Yeah, we're trying to do the right thing, but the Afghans, and I hate to say this, but the only time they seem prideful is when an occupying force is there, and they eventually don't want you there. At first, they realize that you're doing the right thing, but then they're like, okay, time for you to go, you know. And which I mean, I'd probably be the same way too. But you need the Afghans to step up. And instead of, you know, having U.S. forces always front and center, you need the Afghans to do it. It's their country. They need to do it. You know, I mean, we'll help them any way we can, but they need to be front and center on this.
Several times during our conversation, you mentioned that some things that happened in the field. And if you want, you know, tell us what happened. I know that in one case it involved some kids or a child, and in another case it involved another soldier. Can you just talk about what happened to you that you saw that left you with nightmares?
Yeah, two things in particular in Iraq involved two little girls. One, if I remember correctly, it was in August of 08. A car bomb had gone off in a marketplace. It was either a marketplace or a bus station near Balad. I'm not really sure which, but it went off. It was targeting Iraqi civilians. I remember because I was on base in my room eating some cereal, and the blast was so powerful it blew the cereal out of my hand. We thought that we had been hit, but it was miles away. That's how powerful it was. And so when there's mass casualties like that with civilians, I think it was 7 to 10, they bring it to our base and everybody responds. I mean, there's nobody sitting in the rooms. We all go to help. I went, obviously, and I was on a stretcher team, aid and litter team, and they brought in a family, and there was a girl, it was hard to tell that she was, that, you know, was about the same age as my oldest daughter, Brianna. And she was in a lot of pain, and she came in, and we took her to the aid station. I saw that, and it's always bothered me. I can still see her. I mean, like, it never goes away. And it's just something that always sticks with me, and I can't get it out of my head. On patrol, one time, we came to this village, and a little girl had been a dog chain around her neck, and she was tied to a tree like an animal. And the family, I guess, thought she was slow, which, I mean, she was not, but she hadn't looked like she'd been bathed in years. And she looked like 5 or 6, and there was nothing we could do for her. I mean, it was the Iraqi police jurisdiction. We wanted to do something. We wanted to take her, but we couldn't. I mean, that's kidnapping. So we couldn't. We wanted to. All the guys wanted to. But we had to leave her there. And we know, you know, as soon as we left, I mean, she was going to be chained again. I don't even think they took her off the chain. They may have, but I know as soon as we left that it was going to happen again. And that just, it's a lot of anger for me. It's very frustrating, you know, and I still think about that all the time. And you just don't understand, I mean, how brutal that is to see, especially when you have daughters. I mean, some people may not be bothered by it, but it bothers me. And everybody's different, you know, what you can take and what you can't take. And that's something that I can't take. No matter what kind of treatment I get, I'm always going to think about this stuff. It's never going to go away. I just can't block it. I can't shut it off. But I'm hoping that they'll give me a way to deal with it better. You know, and that group, you talk to a group that's been through the same kind of stuff is always good, you know, because you can relate to each other. So that's what I'm hoping for.
Jeff Hanks, it was very kind of you to share this very personal story with us, and I wish you the very best of luck. To you and your family, too, because really, the family is deployed.
Yes, ma'am. I really appreciate the time, and, you know, you let me tell my story. I appreciate it.
You can read more about Jeff Hanks' story in truthout.org. Thousands of U.S. and allied soldiers have been killed or wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Obama administration and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton now say the U.S. is committed to remain in Afghanistan through 2012. Yet international security experts say that these wars have had a negative impact on global security. And as it turns out, the wars started by former President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney have been a catalyst for what appears to be a new nuclear arms race in the Middle East. Journalist, author, and Fulbright scholar David Lindorf hosts the website thiscan'tbehappening.net. We recently asked him if he thought there is a new nuclear arms race going on and what the U.S. role is.
It's hard to know, you know, what exactly is happening. You know, they're not doing testing, but the computer simulation capabilities have reached such a point that they may not need to do testing in order to make newer and deadlier weapons. So they probably are making smaller nukes. There was talk about bunker-busting nukes, that suitcase nukes and things, and I'm sure they've got them all, and they're working on more of these things. So at the level of, you know, the United States, I think we do have an arms race going on, you know, Soviet or Russia, China, countries that are capable of that. And then, of course, at a lower level, you know, of, say, India, Pakistan, maybe Iran, although I haven't seen that case proven, you certainly have a lot of countries that, say, even Saudi Arabia, are capable of buying or creating a bomb. And it's just, you know, as long as we don't have genuine disarmament, you're going to have more and more countries who want weapons. And especially when, you know, when the United States threatens war against a country like Iran, which doesn't have nuclear weapons, it encourages countries that are on America's hit list to want to get a weapon, because look how we treat North Korea. We don't threaten to attack them because they have a nuclear weapon. So, you know, the lesson is, you better get one. That's not a lesson we should be wanting to teach.
The headlines, too, about Turkey. The Turkish people saying, no, we don't want, I think it's ICBMs. We don't want a nuclear deterrent in Turkey because it's not going to be for the people of Turkey. It's going to be for the people of Israel, is, you know, the message that was sent.
Yeah, that's deja vu, isn't it? I mean, it was nuclear weapons in Turkey that led to the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, the real story of the Cuban Missile Crisis was that the United States had put intermediate-range Jupiter missiles in Turkey aimed at Russia, and the Russians putting missiles in Cuba was to counter our missiles next door to them in Turkey. And the deal that was struck, I mean, we always have the myth that, you know, Kennedy stood his ground and, you know, the Russians backed down, they blinked first. But actually what happened was that the U.S. agreed to take the missiles out of Turkey, and then the Russians said, okay, you know, we'll turn around our boats. And that was the deal. So we started it, and the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis was that we backed down in Turkey.
And the reason being given by the U.S. to protect the region from Iran.
They want to put missiles in Turkey and Poland to protect the Europeans against Iran. But why would Iran want to fire a missile at Europe? It's never been an issue. So, you know, really it's aimed at Russia.
Journalist and author David Lindorf, his website, thiscan'tbehappening.net. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated nationally with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for audio and transcripts. Our music is by Fritz Heed.